Hello there. My name is Jay Fox. I'm a co-host with the Passive House podcast, and I'm here today with Anne-Marie Fallon. She is an associate director and Passive House designer with Archetype. She was also just named last year Architects Journal's sustainability champion. And she is going to be presenting not once, not twice, but potentially three times at RB24 coming up soon. And I'm just thrilled to have you here with the podcast. And thank you for joining me. And I guess I just want to know, what are these three presentations that are going to be coming up next month?
Oh, hi, Jay. Yeah, I'm not sure how I ended up signing up for three of them. But anyway, I'm really excited to because I think it's such an exciting event that's happening. So the first of the three is based on one of our projects that was exhibited at COP26 event in Glasgow 2 years ago now, I think. And it was presented as one of the most sustainable buildings in the world. There were seven buildings chosen and exhibited virtually. And it's the Enterprise Centre for the University of East Anglia. We completed it in 2015. We have about 8 years of post-occupancy evaluation on the building. And yes, there's a really exciting narrative around material, whole life carbon. And obviously, of course, it's Passive House, as where Archetype is a Passive House focused practice. The second presentation is on our Passive House, a key Passive House retrofit building of a university building. So the University of Cambridge, their Cambridge Institute of Sustainability Leadership. So very apt building function for the type of building we designed there, which is a retrofit of an old telephone exchange building in an architectural conservation area in Cambridge. And that has been retrofitted to full Passive House Enerfit, which is a Passive House retrofit standard, and possibly the largest retrofitted university building in the UK at the moment. So really exciting to be able to talk about that and the whole life carbon accounting of that building, as well as the operational energy. And then finally, I suppose what I'm most excited about is to talk about projects that I've been working on whilst developing our Scottish studio, Riverside Primary School, which is the first Passive House steel framed primary school in Scotland. And I'll be presenting a lot of data and feedback on the post occupancy phase so far, the lessons learned, and paying attention to the indoor air quality and how the users found the building in the first 6 months. So it got completed last June. So we have some data and we're continuing to collect data from the building as it's as we stand right now.
That's fantastic to hear. And just with, you know, Passive House schools in Scotland in particular, there seems to be quite a bit of projects in the pipeline. How many of these primary schools or secondary schools is Archetype working on currently?
So I understand at this moment in time, there's about 30 schools being developed either on site or at design stage to be Passive House schools in Scotland at the moment. And we're overseeing the delivery of about 20% of those. So my maths is failing me, but about six schools at the moment. And we've just completed the first one, Riverside, last year. And we have a major secondary school coming through now that's currently on site with a swimming pool and leisure centre and sports facilities as well. So that's the first kind of hybrid kind of type to be delivered across the UK as well, I guess. And I guess it's just a very exciting time to be able to deliver Passive House at such a broad scale with also other really good consultants and architects and design teams who've been learning about Passive House in Scotland as well.
That's really fascinating. What we worked on a bit of an article about this, but I guess we should go into it a bit. What's kind of been the big impetus behind Scotland's adoption of Passive House standards, or at least close to Passive House standards for their primary and secondary schools?
So there's two prongs to the Passive House journey, I think, in Scotland. There's a domestic one, which I'll talk a little bit about at the end, potentially. But the non-domestic sector, so the public sector buildings, really arose out of the recent wave of schools delivery where the quality was very, very poor. And that tragically ended in a pupil dying when a cavity wall fell on her back in 2014 on one of the City of Edinburgh schools. And there was various other tragedies and events that happened across construction projects in Scotland, not just the educational sector. And a report very similar to the Grenville tragedy, which produced a report called the Hackett Report. Some of you may have known about the Terror Block fire in 2017, in June 2017 in London, which was a real tragedy. And there's been an inquiry that's still ongoing, I think, about that. There was a report out of that commenting on quality, workmanship, communication, you know, all the issues that led to this tragic event. And actually in Scotland, there was a report called the Cole Report, which very much went into the same similar issues around compliance, information trails, lack of governance, deliverability on site and experience on site, etc. And councils were looking to reinforce how they deliver contracts and procure public sector money, essentially, by how can we ring fence better quality delivery on site as well as from our design teams. And some of the local authorities have picked up on Passive House as a methodology to be able to do that, or standards similar to Passive House, like following the same principles. The other way that we've been able to influence as Archetype, the way forward for Passive House in Scotland, was that in 2017, 2018, we undertook three post-occupancy evaluations of three of the five most expensive recently completed schools in Edinburgh to run operationally. Mm-hmm. And we found a variety of different issues, be it user issues, commissioning issues, basic design, form and massing issues, overheating issues with glazing incorrectly designed and developed alongside ventilation, all sorts of different things, a multi-pronged assessment of how the buildings were performing. And again, that post-occupancy was undertaken by Edinburgh City Council to better their next wave of schools, because, as you'll know from the article, the Scottish Government have an infrastructure vehicle called Scottish Futures Trust, or SFT, and they issue a series of funding rounds for school delivery, in particular, it's called the Learning Estate Investment Programme, or LEAP, as we tend to call it in England, or Scotland, sorry, or I do. And what they did was, after we did the post-occupancy evaluation of these schools, we got them to come down south and visit some of our Passive House schools down south, see how they performed. They came down with a number of different clients as well. And they also visited lots of other schools. And they were really trying to set a benchmark for energy. How do we control, you know, we're spending public sector money, how do we control the quality of these schools, in particular the delivery of operational energy use and indoor air quality and all these other things? So they set a really great way of doing this, which is linking funding to outcomes based on the building performance. So there's a set of graded bands, A to D, and you need to deliver an energy use intensity of a band A for 25 years to release back that funding to the local authority that it would have taken a loan out to deliver that building in the first place. So it really starts linking. And I know there's other places in the world that are looking at this. It was a very formative moment in 2018, 2019 when this started to be talked about, and eventually the first projects progressed. So now we're coming out of the back of those projects being delivered, Riverside being one of them. And other consultants took other paths and maybe chose not to do Passive House. But councils tacitly, SFT, the Scottish Futures Trust, knew that delivering a methodology like Passive House will deliver those energy bands, and therefore those clients will get 100% funding. Mm-hmm. So all 32 local authorities in Scotland really got quite scared, because, you know, their financial directors are used to just getting handed the money first and not having to be accountable for the delivery. And all of a sudden, procurement, upskilling, you know, training centres, visits, knowledge sharing, this huge burst of energy and a real culture change happened across the whole sector. And actually, the contractors started changing first. Commercially, they could see that there was a kind of market requirement for this on the horizon. And also, I guess, to help their own procedures from their quality position as well, that Passive House would help them adopt better practice. And really, you know, we're 5 years on from that now, and it's been phenomenal. And of course, not every project is a Passive House project. There's obviously other schools out there being delivered in a different way. But the mere, you know, the mere delivery and the awareness that Passive House has brought to the industry has really been a game changer for all projects, I would say, all educational projects in Scotland. And retrofit is another big topic, but I think we might not have time to discuss that. But happy to do another slot some other time.
Okay. Well, I guess there's one other point, I guess, you kind of brought up that I want to go back to, which is just like in addition to energy efficiency and, you know, making the schools more energy efficient, it also improves indoor air quality. And I guess I'm curious what your findings have been in the past about how some of these schools that are built to code, or maybe even a little better than code, how they compare to Passive House schools.
So, yeah, a really formative study we did was on our first wave of our own Passive House projects back in between 2012 and 2014, when we delivered a series of different buildings, you know, our naturally ventilated buildings that we did before our passive house schools, and then our first, second and third generation passive house schools. So we took a body of those schools and compared them against a 1970s typical school from the locality around our Hereford office, actually. So we could kind of get in close contact with the operation of that school and being so close. And what we found was, as you might predict, really poor ventilation in the 1970s school, poor indoor air quality, poor fluctuation of temperatures in summer and winter. And as we moved through our generations of naturally, mechanically and passive house generation schools, we found an you know, leaps and bounds improvement on the indoor air quality. Mm. Now, in the UK, for school delivery, there's particular regulations that demand parts per million of 1,000 parts per million or less of CO2 in classrooms with certain other criteria attached. Back in 2014, these schools were achieving what today's requirements are set out in the regulations, barely, from looking at passive house, really, you know, good indoor flow rates, mechanical ventilation with heat recovery. Because we have to remember, it's possibly the same across America, is that mechanical ventilation, whole building mechanical ventilation with heat recovery, really wasn't the first step for ventilation design. It was natural ventilation with some extract. And of course, there's climatic extremes in America that mean you're looking at different ventilation strategies as well. So what we found was that those schools, on a typical winter's week and typical summer's week, we're staying well below those CO2 maximums that were set by regulation. And even now, as we look at our post-occupancy of the Riverside project, which I'll be speaking about, we can see that actually maybe we could even lower the air rates a little, because the CO2 that we're getting as average across all the classrooms is between 500 and 550 parts per million for the much of the school day. Wow. So whilst students are there. So that's led us to go, actually, do you know what? We can maybe, with the engineers and, you know, in collaboration with everybody, the client, etc., that we can start playing with the flow rates, because we know the air quality is that good, and actually start saving the client even more money by balancing that out and exploring how we can get back to maybe a better optimum of 700 to 800 parts per million. So we're very convinced, and we really believe in the air quality and health benefits of passive house buildings. And we have, between this project finished last year in 2023 and the very first schools we monitored back in 2014, a kind of whole plethora of evidence to back that up. And post-COVID, of course, we're all very interested in that. And I think post-COVID, we were just opening windows in classrooms in the UK and letting kids sit there in their jackets and, of course, using loads of energy because the radiators were still on. So that was never going to be a long-term solution. And there's a clever, more efficient way of dealing with air quality that's really positive and healthy for all the occupants.
And is there, this is maybe beyond the scope of the study, but is there any evidence of, you know, comparison of viral transmission within a real world kind of case study between open ventilation and, or natural ventilation and mechanical ventilation, like you see in passive house?
Interestingly, I watched a webinar by the Pacifist Institute on this and the University of Innsbruck that demonstrated that the transmission, if you really wanted to stop air, you know, virally moving around a building, you'd have to introduce, you know, lobbies between classrooms and corridors and all sorts of things. And that really, when you open a door into a classroom, there's a certain volume of air that moves from corridor to classroom in any building. And it's really the balance of getting that extract and supply right, which the mechanical heat recovery does very well, that natural ventilation, it doesn't do well at all, because it's so variable and so dependent on so many other variables. So our managing director had coined a term about ventilation, saying that, you know, really natural ventilation just doesn't work, you know, unless you're kind of in a particularly perfect climate with the right size room and the right size occupancy and the wind blowing in the right way, or buoyancy working with you in a perfect condition. And the reality is many naturally ventilated buildings simply don't work as consistently. They might work occasionally when the parameters are correct, but they don't work as consistently as what we have at mechanical ventilation and heat recovery. So yes, in short, the study doesn't go to that, but the evidence in the graphs, when we look at the 1970s not naturally ventilated, uninsulated school versus the passive house school, are really, really compelling. And similarly with the projects we've done since. Now, I think one caveat to add to that is that we need to be so mindful when we're designing very high performance, very controlled, ventilated, very airtight buildings, that we get the glazing ratios right. Because what we have had observations of is localized overheating in some passive house schools by ourselves in our early stages and by others, where glazing has been too extensive. And that's been driven by daylighting requirements. And it basically exemplifies the issues that designers have in any climate, where you're trying to comply with a series of technical requirements that don't actually speak to each other. Mm-hmm. So what we've been able to do in our last couple of years of schools is go and seek dispensation and say, look, guys, this glazing ratio requirement might help your daylighting, but actually you're going to create an overheating risk if this is the energy requirement that you have. They need to talk to each other to ensure you get a comfortable, good quality, well-lit space, but that minimizes the risk of overheating. And you know, we have a temperate climate in the UK, so we have a heating demand, not a cooling demand. And of course, we might see that change over the next few decades with climate change.
That's true. Well, that all sounds very fascinating, and I'm very excited to hear more about all three of these projects and more come March 7th to 8th, when we're going to be having this giant event. But I just want to say thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I know you're very busy with family.
Yes. You baby keep me busy, but also, yes, loving to be involved in this as well. So yeah, thank you for asking me along.
All right, absolutely. Well, thank you so much, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Thanks for tuning in to this special episode of the Passive House Podcast, featuring some upcoming guests for our Reimagine Buildings 24, happening on March 7th and 8th. Reimagine Buildings is a global online conference that will provide information, connections, and inspiration to make buildings that can change the world. Over the course of 24 hours, we'll circumnavigate the globe, unveiling a new innovative building project every hour, complete with actionable solutions and lessons from around the world. Also, earn AIA credits. RB24 live program sessions will be submitted for AIA CEs in partnership with AIA New York State. And for students, check out our scholarships and special student discounts. Many thanks to NYSERDA for being the stakeholder sponsor of RB24. Register now for Reimagine Buildings 24 and use the promo code PODCAST for a 20% discount.